From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
Paul Birch is my guest. He's a writer, composer, and recording artist. His latest album is called Cry Love, and he's the author of an extraordinary new book about the father of country music, Jimmy Rogers, called Meridian Rising, a novel. Before we meet Paul Birch, let's hear the title track of his new album, Cry Love.
Call a fireman when you've got a fire. Call a waterman when you've got a flood. But when trouble comes to you and you're falling in the blues, I'll be there, call me darling, cry love. Call a handyman when your house blows down. Call a grocer when your cupboard's bare. But when all that's been tried and you still ain't satisfied, I'll be there, call me darling, cry love. Cry love. I got a notion that you won't, you say you will, but then you don't. 'Cause if you cry for love, you'll never live it down. Well, there you go again. The best laid plans of women and men. You end up at the very place where you begin. So let's begin. Call a wino when you need to whine. A moonshiner when you can't sit still. When all the money in your tills still cannot buy you a thrill, I'll be there, call me darling, cry love.
That was Cry Love from my guest, Paul Birch, and he's the author of a great new book. It's called Meridian Rising, a novel. Paul Birch, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you so much.
I like your music. It sounds great.
Thank you. Thanks.
Let's talk a little bit about this book, Meridian Rising. When you mentioned the Marx Brothers in the story, as if possibly Minnie Marx was the source of the yodeling that Jimmy Rogers is famous for, and I think that's kind of a fanciful idea, but it did make me think about genres in American entertainment. And the way they are now and the way they were in that era, you know, to think of Jimmy Rogers as existing in the same world as the Marx Brothers is kind of interesting. I think we think of those days of country music as those people were out in the country, not in a place where they would end up seeing the Marx Brothers. That urban group of comedians seems a world away from Jimmy Rogers. Is that what you were thinking of when you put that in there?
Well, a little bit, but you know, if you ever get to write a book or in your own writing, anybody's writing, your creative self becomes a kind of vacuum cleaner, you know, that's just sucking in everything that's around you. And this book, it's based on the life of Jimmy Rogers. And although, or a particular point in his life where his life was ending and he was traveling to New York for his last recording session, which he famously had to do from a cot because he was so sick with tuberculosis, and he died the next day. But the idea of Minnie Marx came really because I love the Marx Brothers growing up, and a few years had passed since I had seen the films, and I was watching them and was reading a collection of Groucho Marx's interviews, as well as just an overview of the brothers and their work. And it turns out that they were touring throughout the South prior to their film career, and a lot of their skits were worked out on the road, and that their mother traveled with them and she yodeled in the act. And I think Jerry Seinfeld famously, you know, who's a big Marx Brothers fan. I heard him say that, you know, the mother toured with them, and then the father was very sick and very ill, and she went to take care of him in New York. And when she tried to come back on tour with the boys, all the toys were out of the pram, and there was no way that she was ever going to get back on that show because they had been set loose on their own. But I kind of, you know, just thinking about the Marx Brothers and thinking how they were trying to make ends meet on that circuit. They traveled through places that Jimmy went to. And Jimmy really actually, to get to your question, thought of himself as a, well, no, we won't know ever really unless a true memoir arrives what he thought of himself. But I think he angled to be a total entertainer, what we might call a stylist, you know, someone who played all kinds of music. And he wasn't especially fond of what was called hillbilly music. His pull in music really came from the blues and popular tunes. And I think he leaned towards songs that had blue notes in them, but I think he wanted to be an all around entertainer. So it wasn't so far fetched that he would, he would go see the Marx Brothers.
Well, I guess the instrumentation is one of the things that makes a genre, right? I mean, the guitar being the main instrument in a hillbilly record, whereas an orchestra backing Bing Crosby, recorded at the same time, but it puts it in a different realm.
Right. And in Jimmy's case, he tended to be the only guitar player, and he didn't have violin or he didn't have a fiddle playing fiddle licks. He didn't have he did play banjo, but again, the banjo was the main rhythm instrument for a lot of jazz bands. So. Yeah. But you're right. I mean, people just didn't talk about genre in that way, mostly because there was no chart system. Billboard existed, but it didn't start having charts until after World War II. And it sounds like I really know a lot, but a lot of this is just stray facts I came along in reading about Jimmy and wanting to write about him. And I think one of the things that made it kind of easy in a way is that his time is a lot like our time. I mean, the genres don't really matter and the record business has collapsed and charts might mean something to somebody, but it's not, you know, radio is not radio. There's a lot of freeform radio. I mean, this show in a way is creative. It's what you want it to be, but radio hadn't quite begun to see itself as a way of being an arm of the music industry. So musicians were kind of on their own. They were traveling, you know, if the opportunity to make a film or certainly make records, that was something that some musicians really went for. Others did not. And there's probably a great many amount of material of artists out there that just weren't interested in recording. And that's one of the things that sort of set Jimmy apart, is he recognized that one successful 3-minute song could be heard by more people than you could ever reach playing one-nighters.
Well, what amount of research did you do? And I mean, because you've written it as a novel, you're free to say anything you want.
I was, including that Minnie Marx was the inspiration for his yodel. I did quite a lot. I mean, I'm lucky because I live in Nashville and the Country Music Hall of Fame has letters and his song lyrics, which he would type out on the back of hotel stationery wherever he was staying. But they also have quite a few letters collected by the original sort of president of the Jimmy Rogers fan club, who would write to tell him of their experiences with him. So I try to find out as much as I could, you know. I mean, some things are kind of well known, like what kind of guitar he played. But any details I could find, they kind of went into the creative, the creative vacuum. But I was really lucky too, in that his story is really interesting. I mean, at the end of his life, he, as I said, traveled to New York for one final session, which was going to earn him about $40,000 in today's money. Mm. He took with him a nurse who he, I think, had a very honest and very quick friendship with. They got along great. And it was a nurse who actually kind of disappeared from life after Jimmy's death. So there's someone well-known with a great story and someone who's going along for the ride who's kind of mysterious. And I think she was there to make sure that he didn't overdose on his morphine. Excuse me. He was there to make sure that he got there and could perform and probably to give him a little bit of something extra just to give him a boost. But, you know, she was kind of like a unique companion on the trip.
Well, I Peter Guralnick, Elvis Presley's biographer, whose new book is called The Colonel and the King, turned me onto your book, and he told me that it was magical, which it absolutely truly is. And I don't want to destroy any of the magic, but I want to ask, let's see if I can ask it this way. What percentage?
I'll call you El Destructo.
What percentage of Meridian Rising, a novel, would you say is factual?
Well, I'd say that there are pillars that are tried and true. Everyone in the book, except for one figure you'll meet and hear about, is true. And he really did take this final trip to New York that I mythologize. And the experiences that are in the book, the way people remember him, there's sort of dual stories going on. You're hearing Jimmy's voice and hearing about his life from his point of view. And then every other chapter is an interview with it, hosted by a figure who's revealed at the end. And it's interviews with people who Jimmy knew, his wife, a fantastic figure named H.C. Spear, who was a talent scout in Jackson, Mississippi, and Sam Chapman, member of the Mississippi Sheiks, which is one of the more impactful and popular groups at the time. Ralph Peer, who was Jimmy's producer. And all of these people existed, and the tone of their recollections are true. With the possible exception of Sam, I don't know if I know Sam really existed. He was a fascinating person. There's a rumor I never tracked down that Sam backed up Jimmy, played bass on a dance for him. Mm. And that has the ring of truth only because Sam did play bass. The whole thing gave me a chance to write about this world that existed in Jimmy's time, where both black and white musicians saw him as an ideal entertainer, someone who looked sharp, was independent, wrote his own songs, arranged his own songs, was a stylist in such a way where he could really play any tune from any kind of style of music and make an impression on someone. And, you know, through Peter Guralnick's book, we know that Robert Johnson behind the scenes was that kind of person as well. The people who traveled with him would say, well, he played a wonderful version of Tumble and Tumbleweeds by Sons of the Pioneers, and that he sung Jimmy Rogers songs. Mm. And Robert's stepsister made a wonderful memoir a few years ago where she said they used to sit out on the stoop in their house in Memphis, and they'd listen to Uncle Dave Macon and the Grand Ole Opry, and they'd harmonize on Waiting on a Train. So to me, as a musician, those things sound very true and they're very sweet. I mean, the musicians I know who one might think they're in a particular style of music, they know so much music. Remember once, for instance, this is sort of far-fetched, but one time I was a guest of Exene Cervenka from the band X.
Sure.
It was a super nice, you know, lovely person to me. And she used my studio to rehearse. And she said, well, come out to California and open some shows and you can just stay in my guest room, which I did. And she had an incredible record collection, black gospel, 40s and 50s, rhythm and blues and jazz. I mean, she knew so much music and had so much music around the house that was regularly in circulation. And we, you know, she told me all about the beginning of X and things like that, but we never really talked about punk rock. I mean, it was in her head, you know, that music from that time, and it was in her heart, but the music she was listening to was all over the place. Hmm. So in a way, you know, things like that informed the book. So there's a lot of, there's more truth. The story itself is an invention, but it takes place in places that where Jimmy really visited. And there's even a scene in the book where at the end, he sort of takes a trip away from New York City into a place that is either very real, is very dreamlike, whether it's in a dream or not, it's hard to say. But he actually took a mysterious trip to Cape Cod, of all places, during the 2 or 3 weeks he was in New York to record. And I could never find out why he went there or what happened there. I mean, of all the places to go to the beach, he could have just gone to Coney Island. But he really did go to Cape Cod. And so that's kind of how my mind worked. Like, if I found out he went somewhere and I could find out something interesting that happened there, or if I knew the hotel, I would write about it. But if I didn't, I'd say, well, maybe in my story, he's going to take a journey, but it's going to go somewhere else.
But we're talking to Paul Birch, and his new book is called Meridian Rising, a novel, and it's based on the life of Jimmie Rodgers. We heard one of your tracks earlier. Let's hear a Jimmie Rodgers track, but tell me which one.
Oh, let's play a tune called Let Me Be Your Sidetrack, which is a song. There's two versions. There's one with just Jimmy, but let's hear the one that he recorded with a wonderful blues guitar player, Clifford Gibson. This was unreleased in Jimmy's lifetime. And I really, this song sort of set off the whole shebang for me, because Clifford was a really wonderful guitar player. He was a modern blues guitar player of the time. He had a really great vocabulary on the instrument. And his playing reminded me from a distance some of the phrasing, because he was playing in a unique tuning. When I first heard it across a room, it had the kind of echoes of someone who had Robert Johnson's style, but with Jimmy's voice. And that just totally knocked me out. So, yeah, it's called Let Me Be Your Sidetrack. It was recorded in Louisville, Kentucky, about 2 years before Jimmy died.
Let me be your sidetrack till your main line comes. Let me be your sidetrack till your main line comes. Cause I can do more switching than your main line's ever done. De-o-de-lay, lay-o, de-o-de-lay. When you see a spider climbing up a lonesome wall, when you see that spider climbing up a wall, you can tell the world he's gonna get his ashes hauled. De-o-de-lay-o, de-o-de-lay-o, de-o-de-lay-o.
That was Jimmie Rodgers, and he is the subject of a new book by my guest, Paul Birch. The book is called Meridian Rising, a novel, and that was a great track. Thank you. And he was an interesting and amazing and influential entertainer. What? Let me ask you to tell me, what do you think the influence of Jimmie Rodgers in American popular music is?
Well, I think the idea of a stylist, we talked about that earlier, someone who can play a lot of kinds of music. Jerry Lee Lewis, what did he say? His, you know, there's only been four entertainers, you know, Hank Williams, Al Jolson, Jimmie Rodgers, and Jerry Lee.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that's something that still excites people. Somebody who is making their pull from a particular kind of music, but just appeals to everybody. And I'm sure someone will come out like that, but you know, in modern times, it's a little funky right now. But if there's something that happens in the world of music that can only be heard in clubs and takes people out of the house and out of their inner world, that might change things. But in Jimmy's case, he was, he was incredibly impactful. I think I have to wonder that some of it might have had to do with, you know, the change of the United States becoming a place where most people lived outside of cities to a place where most people lived in cities. And, you know, he was that kind of figure that was hitting the airwaves, hitting your record player during that transition where a lot of people thought, well, there's nothing for me in this town. Where do I go? And here's someone who sings about traveling and mentions a lot of cities by name. And he dresses in a custom suit and he drives a custom Cadillac and he plays a guitar with his name on it. And he comes across as being very personable. And I think that was true. He seems to be honestly very well liked. But he also had that kind of aloofness that certain artists have where you can't, you know, you can, they're not trying to keep you at arm's length, but there's something about them that's unknowable. And so you throw a lot of stuff at them. They, you know, they can absorb your dreams, so to speak. And I think, you know, he is kind of a town square where all the my favorite musicians can meet. I mean, he recorded with Louis Armstrong. Howlin' Wolf was a friend. So many artists that were impactful all through my life, B.B. King, George Harrison, Sam Phillips, founder of Sun Records, Dolly Parton, Bob Dylan, they all cite Jimmy as being one of the first records played in their home. And a record player was a really special thing, you know. I mean, some people didn't have books or art, but they had music. They had their art form coming. The art form of their home was music. And so Jimmy was one of those people that everybody could agree on.
Well, I first discovered him, I think, in the 1960s when I got a reissue record. It was on RCA that had him in every picture I saw of him. He was wearing a train, an engineer's
Right.
And so when you talk about him wearing suits, and as you do in the book, he's a snappy dresser. I always think of him, in the brakeman's outfit that he wore on every picture I've ever seen.
Yeah, I found out that he discarded that pretty quickly. I think when he realized he was appealing to a lot of people, it was much better to just wear a simple suit than to be thought of as the singing railroad guy. But I'm sure he would have called himself the singing parrot if that would have got him a gig, you know. I sure would, you know. You kind of have to jump on whatever is lucrative. But I think it's one of those things about his life. There's a lot of cliches, you know, the singing brakeman and father of country music, but he didn't care for hillbilly music, and he actually got rid of the singing brakeman garb pretty quickly.
Well, your book does have a whole lot of wonderful black and white pictures and pictures of record labels, 78 records, so you can really see what the music looked like when it came out, which I love.
No,
I appreciate
you.
That. I like the idea of, you know, one of the reasons that I still collect records, and probably you do too, is even though you could ask your streaming service, whatever it is, to play it for you, it's not the same as holding this icon, this artifact of the past when you put it on your record player.
Well, you're right. And I'm kind of keen to, when I can, especially for artists I really like, is to listen to it in the form that their fans would have heard it. So if you have a record player at home or you want to get one and you love music from this time, you know, every once in a while, just get like one or two 78s from an artist you really like. And some of those will, especially if you listen to one that's in really good shape, it will knock you out because they're running at a faster speed. The mastering process, they're just by matter of electricity and the process, they're going to sound a little bit different. And I remember the first time I heard Elvis Presley's Sun sessions on a 78. I mean, the music and Peter, that was Peter would say, you know, it couldn't get any fresher, but some of those records really sound extraordinary when you get a chance to listen to them the way that they were originally distributed. And that's a hard thing to, when you're listening to a mass of music, it's hard to zero in on one tune, but I'm still someone who will happily play one tune over and over again if I love it. But this is a culture, you know, what's coming in and what we're writing about and listening to, where there's just a lot of stuff, you know, there's a lot of stuff that is not disposable. You know, when the 19th century came into the 20th century, there was so much new that seemed inevitable, electricity and radio and communication and being able to reach someone overnight, which in Jimmy's time, he had that same collapse of communication or collapse of distance that we do now. But it's a funny thing. You know, we have lots of communication and lots of music at our disposal. Jimmy was somebody who was a receiver of music. You know, wasn't a writer, like an everyday writer, like, say, our favorite authors or some musicians. He wasn't a writer like Bob Dylan or Loretta Lynn, who was constantly writing songs, you know. But he was a creative person, and he seemed to, I mean, I'm probably projecting, but he seemed to be someone who had this sense that something different was about to happen. And he seemed to be more comfortable in trying to please himself and sort of equating that with being able to also please a lot of people. You know, the idea of being a stylist or being a popular musician who plays what they want to play, not necessarily what you're asking to hear. And also he's credited with doing such a variety of music, but a lot of that was kind of by accident too, because he was partying so much and traveling so much that he would often come to sessions underprepared. So I think a lot of what got on record was his sense of like, well, what haven't we done? You know, let's try this. In other words, he wasn't someone who was coming into the studio with a set idea of let's do some Western swing style things or cowboy things. Many of his sessions could have been influenced by what movie he just saw or musicians he saw on the street. There's more than one anecdote or remembrance of him going out into the street to listen to street musicians and hearing someone he liked and saying, I'm Jimmy Rogers, coming to the studio and record with me. So he was loose. He was very loose. He was confident that something would work out. And
well, Jimmy Rogers and the people around him really in his time really come to life on the page in Meridian Rising, a novel. And the author, my guest, Paul Birch, who's also a wonderful musician. His new album is called Cry Love. Paul Birch, thanks so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and thank you for enjoying the book.
Film historian Scott Brogan is my guest. He's the keeper of an amazing Judy Garland online archive called The Judy Room, and he's the author of a beautiful new book called Judy Garland, The Voice of MGM, which is a real treasure for admirers of the legendary Judy Garland, like me. Scott Brogan, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
So, Scott, you know, there are so many great movie stars of the golden age of Hollywood that were contemporaries of Judy Garland. I mean, it was Deanna Durbin or Shirley Temple or Jeanette MacDonald or Betty Grable. And lots, they were all tremendous stars, but most people don't have any idea who they are now, but they all still love Judy Garland. Why do you think Judy has this hold, this fascination for us?
Well, I actually think it's twofold. One, of course, is The Wizard of Oz. You know, so many people still grew up with the movie, usually on disc or now on streaming, of course, and also on just, you know, now TCM shows it, you know, fairly regularly. And then also, I think it's her voice, her talent. People really respond to things like Get Happy from Summer Stock, the adult Judy Garland. I think that her performances are so brilliant. And so she was such a one-of-a-kind talent. People really respond to that. And I really enjoy seeing a lot of these first-time watching videos on YouTube. And you'll see young people watching her sing Old Man River from her TV series as the adult Judy, and they only know her as Dorothy, and they'll watch the video and they're completely blown away. I mean, she just crosses the generations, and I think that's probably why. I mean, Betty Grable, of course, was a huge star at the same time that Judy was, and Shirley Temple, but it is kind of interesting how they're not as remembered as she is.
Yes, I mean, of course, The Wizard of Oz, and when I was a kid in the pre-video days, we would wait. We would just wait for them to show it. And I had also, like you, and I read in your book, committed it to memory. But, you know, I had to do it just on yearly showings, just watch it. I didn't even have a tape recorder then. I just watch it, and then I would go to school the next day and said, oh, that feels wonderful. I've held that axe up for ages. And I just had sections of it memorized. And so I do think, I think it's maybe the baby boomer generation that benefited most from those yearly showings. But you point out in your book, and I was fascinated by this, there are so many kind of, I don't know if you want to call them legends about The Wizard of Oz, that you take the time to tell us are all false. It was not a flop when it came out, for instance.
Oh, it wasn't. No, that's what people people like to tell that story. And a lot of that, and I hate to say this about Al Jean Harmitz's book, because her book is very wonderful in a lot of ways, because it was the first book that came out devoted to the making of the film. And it was the first time a lot of those behind the scenes images and matte painting images and things were shown. She did kind of perpetuate that myth that it was a flop when it came out. And it wasn't. It was very popular and everybody loved it, but it was so expensive. It was what MGM would call their prestige pictures, which they did every few years. Usually they would do a movie that could show off what the studio could do, but they weren't expecting to make it, to really make money off of it. I mean, if they made money, great. If they didn't, they could take the loss because they were a big enough studio to take that. So, but it was very, very popular. But we also have to keep in mind that so many of the tickets were at children's prices. So that lowered it as well. And then right after the film came out, the Nazis invaded Poland. So that kind of chopped off the European market. So that didn't help either. And it didn't really go into the black until its 1949 re-release, which is another myth, because people think it didn't start making money until, or wasn't popular until the TV showings that started in 1956. But actually it was 1949 when it actually went back into the black, because it was a masterpiece reprint, as they called it. And it was again very popular.
And it's also untrue that Louis B. Mayer wanted Shirley Temple and didn't want Judy Garland?
That's true. Yeah. The producers of the film, everyone, it was written with Judy Garland in mind. I mean, if you go back to one of the very early, what do I want to say, like memos that Arthur Freed wrote, and with a list of casting ideas and character ideas. And it says, Dorothy Gale, an orphan in Kansas who sings jazz. And that obviously wasn't Shirley Temple. So, yeah, and Judy was known at the time as a swing singer, especially on radio. Now they did go, allegedly they did go to, they sent Roger Edens to, 20th Century Fox to meet with Shirley and hear her and everything, and just kind of as a sort of a courtesy thing. But I don't know if it was actually Louis B. Mayer who wanted Shirley Temple. I think it was more the money men in New York and Lowe's Incorporated who were like, well, maybe we should get Shirley Temple. But it was very brief and it was very minor. But because of who Shirley Temple was, it's been blown into this big legend about, oh, she only got the role because, you know, Shirley Temple wasn't available.
Well, Scott Brogan, your new book, The Voice of MGM, Judy Garland, it's like a day-by-day accounting of Judy's career from the time that she was a child through her time at MGM. What kind of research did you put into this, and how do you know all this stuff?
Many years of research, many years. I mean, like any and every book I could get my hands on, from the very first major Garland biography that came out in 74 by Gerald Frank, which was Judy, which is the big best-selling book, that one, and then also Young Judy that came out at the same time, which is all about her life and career up to her audition with MGM in 1935 when she first got hired by them. And so I was just fascinated by her life. And so I just, any book about Hollywood musicals, MGM, MGM musicals, and of course about her, I would get and read. And then I started doing more and more research at newspaper archives, various archives. And then of course, more books were coming out with more and more information. And so it just kind of grew from there. And then as I started the website, I started doing even more research. So that's how it all happened.
And you have, and I know you have an enormous collection because I see beautiful pictures in this book, which is virtually a coffee table book. In fact, I'm using it as a coffee table right now. all of the these beautiful pictures, and they say from the collection of the author. So you must have this enormous collection. When did you start collecting?
I started collecting probably about like 9 or 10 years old when I was first into The Wizard of Oz, because I'm part of the late boomer. Like I was born at the tail end of the boomer generation. So I got a lot of the benefits of the boomer generation. and I was at the right, we lived mostly overseas, but I was, we lived stateside at the right time. I was the right age for the annual showings of The Wizard of Oz to kind of have their effect on me, work their magic, so to speak. And so I just started collecting from that time. And it's funny that you mentioned that it is a coffee table size book. And it's funny when people open it up thinking it's just going to be a picture book. And a couple of times people have opened it up and they're like, oh, there's a lot of text in here. And I'm like, well, it is an actual biography.
It truly is. I mean, and this and the writing is quite good. So thank you for writing.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
But it doesn't go. I mean, will there be a volume two? Is there more?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would love to do the obvious follow up. There's a lot of people have asked me that, you know, obvious follow up would be the concert years or something called similar to that. I have to get with my publisher and see if they're up to it. Sales have been really, really good. So I would think that they would be up to it. I mean, I would love to do it. I think it would be really wonderful to have another book out there that is devoted to that time of her life, because the MGM years, this is the first time a book has been published that's done a deep dive into just her MGM years. Other books, of course, obviously all the biographies and everything are about her entire life, which is great. And then there's been some filmography, coffee table books and things that have come out, but there's never been a deep dive. And it's the same with the concert years. And her life and career encompassed so much. She accomplished so much in her 47 years. I mean, I tell people, they ask me how old was she when she died, and they say 47. They're like, wow, I can't believe that. You know, she accomplished so much that you just can't put all of it in one book, I think, and really capture it all and really show to the reader just how much she contributed and how much she gave of herself for her art.
Well, especially because, as I mentioned, the sort of day-by-day aspect of your book. I mean, it not only tells you a lot about Judy Garland, but it gives you an idea of what it was like to be a movie star in the golden age of Hollywood. I mean, it was hard work.
It was. I mean, they had to get up at the, you know, at the crack of dawn, or before the crack of dawn, really, and get to the studio early. And it was a lot of hard work, and it was really hard on all of the stars, especially. There was so much pressure riding, you know, on the success of a film. And especially filming Technicolor musicals back then, they had those huge giant cameras, you know, that were really hard to move around. And so you had to be on for every single take, because every take mattered and you really had to be on. And Ann Miller was interviewed for That's Entertainment Part 3. And in the documentary for that, which you probably saw, she talks about how you had to get into your face makeup and have your hair done and your body makeup and all of this at like 6 o'clock in the morning. And she said, so by the time you got to the set at like 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, that's when your day began and you were already tired.
Oh Oh, and then
so, you know, I can see where it would, and especially for someone like Judy Garland, who was very sensitive, she was actually insecure a lot about her talent at times, which is hard for us to believe, but she just, you know, her bad was what we would consider great, but if she felt like she wasn't going to be good, then she didn't want to perform.
You consider her an actress who could sing rather than a singer who was in the movies?
Yeah, especially while she was at MGM. I mean, I kind of go back and forth because, of course, she had such an amazing voice and she was such an amazing singer and she could, of course, do records and everything, as of course she did, and concerts and all of that. But she was such a great natural actress. You know, when you watch her perform in her movies, she comes across so natural. Her acting was so natural that you don't even realize that she's acting. And a lot of the actresses at the same time period, you know, were a little more actressy, if that makes sense. Not that they weren't great. I don't mean it that way, but you could kind of tell. And with her, I think they kind of overlooked her a lot because she was so natural. It didn't seem like she was acting. So people didn't think of her as like an actress, you know, it was just more like she was a great singer. And it's like, well, no, she was a great actress.
Well, even when you watch her sing Over the Rainbow in The Wizard of Oz, it's one of the most touching, not only is it a beautiful song, but her performance of it is really touching. And it's interesting to know that it was, I judge from your book, and you talk about the pre-recordings, that she's lip syncing in that shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now I don't know if she developed it by this time, but I know like in A Star Is Born and in other movies, she would sing along with her pre-recording. Now, I don't know if she was doing that by that point in The Wizard of Oz or not. I haven't read it or learned anything about that, but she was definitely lip-syncing for sure. But that's still my all-time favorite version of Over the Rainbow by her, or by anyone really, but by her. You know, I like the Carnegie Hall version and the adult versions and all of that, but it's just the look on her face and the way that she just performs it. So it's just magic. You know, it's lightning in a bottle. It's just a one of a kind marriage of a singer and a song at the right time in the right place. And I never get tired of watching that.
Well, now this wasn't at MGM, but when she sings The Man That Got Away in The Star Is Born, it's hard to believe she's lip syncing that. It looks like she's singing it live.
Yeah. Now that was, she was lip syncing, but she was also singing with her own voice. And I have to look it up, but I think it was George Cukor who said that, I think he was the one who said it was very discerning because it was like she was in competition with her own voice. So she would get louder and louder with her own voice as she's singing with herself and filming it at the same time. And that's another incredible song and performance of hers.
It's so incredible, that particular performance, because the camera does not cut away for a single second. And it doesn't even move. It's just a shot where the camera is just there on her widescreen camera. And she just is performing. It really is an amazing performance.
And when you think about it, you know, when we see these things that are done in one take, and you think that that's not the only take that was done, if you think about it that way, you realize, wow, that person had to bring that kind of intensity to each take. It's just incredible that anybody could do that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing performance. Let's talk about her movies then.
Sure.
Scott Brogan. Scott Brogan, my guest, is the author of a new book about Judy Garland, the voice of MGM. What's your favorite of, let's just set aside The Wizard of Oz for a moment. And what are your favorite MGM performances from Judy? What films, if people are unfamiliar with her other films, where should they start?
Well, I'm glad that you said The Wizard of Oz is kind of, put that aside, because I always, when people ask me what my favorite movies are, I always say, well, The Wizard of Oz is in a class by itself. So, you know, I can't even, but if somebody only knew The Wizard of Oz and didn't know her movies, I would say, watch Meet Me in St. Louis, because it's such a beautifully filmed movie and she's so beautiful in it. And of course, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas and the Trolley Song and The Boy Next Door are all great songs and performances. But I think for me, and I tell people this all the time because it's black and white, so it's not as well known. Most people kind of gravitate towards the color films now more so. But for Me and My Gal with Judy and Gene Kelly from 1942, she runs the gamut in that. Her acting is amazing. She shows off how she can keep up with Gene Kelly dancing, and that was his first film. And her singing, of course, is wonderful. Her comedy, all of it, it's the first time – and. Well, it's the first time that she's able to show that off to that degree in any film. And it's also her first true adult film where she's an independent woman, adult woman. She's not Betsy Booth. She's not, you know, she's not Mickey Rooney's sidekick or anything like that. She's not a little girl. She's not a teenager. She's an adult, and she's desired by two men in the film, Gene Kelly and George Murphy. And it's just a really, really great film that shows what vaudeville was like before, during, and after World War One. It's really like a really good, they do a really great job of portraying that era, probably as good or better than most films that take place in that era. And so I like to tell people to definitely watch that because she's just so good in it. I mean, they both are, but...
Gene Kelly. That was a pretty good start to Gene Kelly's career, I would think.
Co-starring with Judy Garland, that's one way to start.
What was the first film she did at MGM, other than the Andy Hardy movie where they cut her songs out? What was the first one she did just as a dramatic actress without any singing at all?
Well, that would be The Clock in 1945. And you're right, you know, Life Begins for Andy Hardy was supposed to have a few songs and they cut them all out. So technically, that's her first non-singing role, but not on purpose. But The Clock is, and that was right after she had done Meet Me in St. Louis, and she had filmed her part for Ziegfeld Follies, even though it wouldn't come out for a couple of years. And she had wanted to do a dramatic role and prove herself as a dramatic actress. And so they indulged her. And the movie is a wonderful wartime romance, and it's a very sweet, sweet story with her and Robert Walker. And obviously, of course, she does prove herself as a dramatic actress, and the reviews were great. But the thing is her talent, her singing kind of worked against her on that because people wanted to hear her sing, you know, and the movie was popular, but it wasn't a huge blockbuster hit like her recent movies had been. And I think a lot of it is because people were a little disappointed that she didn't sing.
It's one of those movies you talk about in your book in which it takes place in New York, and it very convincingly looks like it's in New York, but it's all shot at Culver City.
Yeah. Vince Minnelli did a great job with the rear projection. I mean, some of it's obviously rear projection, you know, but some of it's not. And they, he did a really great job of making New York, and this is kind of famous now for the movie to Judy fans, is making New York a third character. Because from the very beginning, it seems like the city is trying to keep them apart. But they just used rear projection. They used the New York streets. It's a great tour of MGM's back lot, of the New York streets on their back lot, because they're all over those New York streets, you know, filming everywhere. So he was able to really make it convincing in the hustle and bustle. You feel the vibrancy of the city, and you feel like I said, the hustle and bustle and the movement and everything, and they get all caught up and they get separated and they try to find each other. You know, and it's just a really, really wonderful movie. And at that time, she was basically doing nothing but period films. She was always in period costume at that point. And so it's nice to see her as an adult in contemporary clothing of the time period in that. And she's just absolutely lovely.
For the first 15 years of her career, she did a lot of work on the radio. Have you listened to all of those, and how was she as a radio performer?
Yeah, I've listened to everything that's available. There's a lot out there that's not available that people are still searching for. She was a regular on the Jack Oakey program Jack Oakey, for listeners, was a very popular movie star and comedian, and he had a very popular radio show. He was kind of like the, you know, he was always the sidekick to the leading man, you know, and he was a very affable, you know, good comedian. And he did a little bit of singing. But his radio show is very popular, and she became a regular on his radio show very early on in her MGM career. And she was a weekly regular. And so she got to sing a lot of songs that she wouldn't have had the chance to sing in any of her movies, and a lot of songs that she didn't record for Decca Records. And, so that gave her the chance to kind of, spread her wings a little bit, vocally. But she was quite popular. And it's interesting because MGM had her on the radio before they had her in a film. Because they wanted to get audiences used to her, because some people were afraid that, of course, this is the story anyway, some people were afraid that people might not think that was, if they saw her on screen for the first time, didn't know anything about her, that they would think that was somebody else's voice that she was lip syncing to, you know, that they wouldn't believe it was her.
Right.
So the radio helped give her a recognition with audiences, and it also gave audiences a chance to listen and hear her sincerity. She had a natural sort of just niceness and sincerity about her, especially at that time.
There was never a Judy Garland show on the radio. There should have been, huh?
No. Actually, they wanted to. I mentioned this in the book. Right around 45, 46. One of the networks went to MGM and said, well, we'd love to have a radio show. But she was just so busy at the studio at the time. And that was when she was beginning to have the ups and downs. And there was no way she could have sustained a weekly show at that point. Because at that point, she wasn't doing any weekly guest appearances either.
What about her career as a recording artist? You mentioned that she was with Decca and then later Capitol and some other labels too. How do you rate her as a recording artist? What are your favorite records?
Of course, Judy Carnegie Hall is always everyone's favorite, I think, as far as the adult Judy, because it captures her concerts for anyone. I mean, I was alive when she was alive, but I was too young and we lived overseas, so I never got a chance to see her live. But when you listen to the recording, you get an idea. I mean, there's a kind of electricity that comes out of the recording that, and I think that's why it was such a huge, you know, 5-time Grammy winning hit. But she was one of the youngest artists signed to a recording contract with a label in the mid 1930s. And she made her, well, she did those Decca tests in 1935, and then in late 1935, she did two other Decca tests, and those tests were rejected. And those are two recordings that are the holy grail for Garland recordings, because those are lost and no one's ever heard them. But then in 1936, she recorded two songs and they released it as a single, you know, front and back. And for those who don't know what records are, I forget that people, there's a front and a back. And then in 1937, she had her actual contract with Decca Records, and that lasted until the late 40s. That lasted 10 years till 1947, because MGM formed MGM Records in 1946, and the first album that came out was Till the Clouds Roll By, the soundtrack to the movie, and she's in Till the Clouds Roll By. She has a guest spot, and that was released in 1947. And so Decca Records, she was coming to the end of her contract, and her workload was such that she just couldn't sustain that. So she didn't re-up with Decca Records, and they realized that they weren't going to be able to do the cast albums that they were doing of songs from movies that were studio recordings from movies. And so, so then she was on MGM Records, basically, and those were all just the soundtracks of her most recent, like In the Good Old Summertime, Easter Parade, all of that, Summerstock. And then after she left MGM, she recorded four sides for Columbia Records, and they didn't really make much of an impact or anything, and it was a short-lived contract. And then in 1955 was her first album, actual long playing LP album like we know today. And that was with Capitol Records, and that was Miss Show Business. And then she had her recording contract with Capitol until the mid 1960s. And that included, you know, Carnegie Hall and all of those. But my favorite Capitol album aside from Carnegie Hall is 1957's Alone.
I love that one.
Yeah, it's very unusual for her because people think of her as, you know, show tunes and brassy, jazzy. And in this one, she gets very sort of bluesy and sings some like very mellow songs and things that you wouldn't think that she would sing. And she really shows off her versatility in that. And she's sounds wonderful.
And it's got a beautiful picture of her on the cover. It's a beautiful album. It's really a good concept album, I guess you'd say.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's absolutely wonderful. And I love the picture of her, although people like to joke about how she's on the beach in high heels. And I'm like, that's the 50s.
Judy Garland. She never went anywhere without high heels.
Well, if you watch in her movies, you know, as I became more and more familiar with her movies, I realized in almost every single number where she's dancing, especially like when she does Who Until the Clouds Are By with all those men, she's always dancing in high heels. Hmm. And they look pretty high to me. I mean, I don't know how she did it, but.
Well, of course, that Get Happy number, she's wearing that tuxedo jacket and no pants.
And high heels. Yeah. Oh, yeah, so she's working it. Yeah.
Looks so great in that. That's a great I think that might be her great, one of her greatest. I mean, there's so many that are great, but that's one of her greatest adult performances, I would think.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that's one that a lot of people have imitated, but they just don't quite, it's just not the same. You know, it's just one, it's just like her singing Over the Rainbow in The Wizard of Oz. Nobody else could do that in that setting, you know. But I do love, like I said before, I have seen a couple of those reaction videos where people watch Get Happy. And these are, once again, people in like their 20s and 30s, you know, and I sound so old. And I am. But anyway, and they're always just blown away. And I think that's really great, you know, that people can watch something that's old, you know, and actually enjoy it and respond to it just like somebody would have in 1950 when the film came out.
Well, Judy Garland is timeless, and that is evident in this marvelous new book that I think everybody would love. It's called Judy Garland, The Voice of MGM, and the author and compiler of some beautiful photographs is my guest, Scott Brogan. Scott, thanks for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I've had a wonderful time, obviously, talking about my favorite subject.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.